These contents and its intention give our consciousness its shape or form. So that consciousness, human consciousness, usually has some particular kind of a shape or form or structure. And finally, energy is that which enables consciousness to work. If we don't have any energy, if we just had attention and intention and contents, well, some of these contents are themselves a kind of energy, nothing would happen. There would be just seeing. There would be Shiva without Shakti. You just see, but you couldn't do anything and nothing would be happening. There's all different kinds of experiences of energy. Feelings are a kind of energy. Thoughts are a kind of an energy. So some of these contents of consciousness are also experiences of energy. But there is a basic kind of an energy that is undifferentiated into thought and feeling that Jung would call libido, and Freud would call the id. And in the yogic literature, this is where we begin to speak of the Shakti or Kundalini as the basic bottom line undifferentiated energy which has not yet been colored by anything. Any questions about this so far? And let's talk about different kinds of consciousness or states of consciousness. We recognize then that there are different ways of combining. Yes, a couple of questions here.
When you were drawing those circles and you said that it's not only in the basement but it's in the attic.
Yeah, right.
What were you talking about?
I was saying the unconscious is not just only repressed material that we don't want to look at. It's also undeveloped potential. Okay? Yes.
When you use the word Shakti, is that another form of the word chakra?
No. I'm going to repeat the questions for the tape here. The word Shakti is not a synonym for chakra. It's another word for energy, for the energy of consciousness. I'm going to start using that instead of the Hindu language since we're more familiar with it. Okay, so it's just pure psychic energy. Think of it like that, okay? Anything else? All right, that's consciousness. Well, if this makes sense, then you can see there are different combinations of content, energy. There are different shapes of consciousness, different combinations of intentionality, content, energy, and awareness. And so let's look at that, at different kinds of consciousness. And again, in some broad general categories. First, there is what we might call normal consciousness, right? What is that? Normal consciousness is the everyday consciousness that human beings experience to orient themselves in and around the culture. It's presided over by the ego, the major content out of which this consciousness is working is the self-image. So it's the ego can control the energies that it is experiencing. It can direct intentionality one way or another. And that's how most people experience their consciousness, is as an ego consciousness that is oriented toward getting around in the culture, that is very much attached to the self-image, working out of the self-image. The self-image gives this consciousness its structure. It stands on the one hand in relation to the culture, and on the other hand, it is facing the unconscious. So it's between the world and the unconscious is this ego. And its major project is the self-image. And this is, if you ask a person who's operating out of this state, who are you, they'll begin to describe their self-image. They'll tell you where they come from, the roles that they play, the things that they like to do, the different things they're identified with, their nation, their church, their family. They'll talk to you about their self-judgments and whether they're tall or short or smart or dumb. All those things that go into self-image. And as we know, if the self-image is a very negative experience for the person, that this will affect the kind of energy they experience as well. It will be a very negative kind of energy. And it will affect their intentionality, will be maybe very unrelating. Abnormal consciousness, then, is a consciousness where the ego can't keep it together, where the energies that are coming into the ego, either from the outside world or from the inside world of the unconscious, cannot be integrated. That's too much. The self-image is inadequate to incorporate these energies or these contents or whatever is coming in. We can see it. You can always see it. There's always observation, but there's an inability to integrate it. A good example of this would be the person who suffers from the psychological disease of manic depression. If a person has this disease, then from time to time, the energy that's coming into the ego is so powerful and so weighted in a certain direction, either to extreme euphoric joy or deep sorrowful depression, they just can't turn it around. You can tell them to read Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie and to use affirmations and all of that, but they can't turn it around with their thinking. It's overpowering, okay? And so that we'd say is an abnormal kind of consciousness. Or schizophrenia as well, where the whole structure of the ego seems to change, where one whole system of self-image seems to be replaced by another system that comes out of nowhere. Or as multiple personality disorders as well. Not only can the ego not keep it together, you get different egos appearing on the scene, which raises the question, who's there? Which one is the person? Not always easy to answer that. Now, modern psychiatry has spent a lot of time studying abnormal states of consciousness, and they know a great deal about it. They've got a big, thick book that describes these things called the Diagnostic Style Manual, and it's revised in its third edition now, and they have long, articulate descriptions of many kinds of abnormal consciousness. There's another, I'm going to write these up. We said normal, and abnormal consciousness. And now I'm going to talk about altered states of consciousness. An altered state of consciousness is one where the ego is not directing what's happening. The ego is not in the middle of what's happening. But it's not necessarily a pathological experience, like, let's say, a manic depressive experience or a multiple personality disorder kind of experience. When a person is drunk, for example, on alcohol, well, the ego is there, but it's not running the show. You're in an altered state of consciousness. What is happening, your intentionality, the kind of energy you experience, even the contents you hold on to, these are being much more influenced by the drug. The drugs bring one into altered states of consciousness. There might still be an ego observer, but it may find itself way on the sidelines, you know, watching from a distance. We say it's not necessarily pathological because the person can come out of this in a short period of time. They can resume a normal and healthy life. Altered states are usually related to some circumstance which the ego volunteers itself into. Or in the case of addiction, maybe it's not volunteering, but it is nonetheless entering into. Altered states of consciousness can also be induced by some particular forms of meditation, of breathing, using pranayama kinds of breathing exercises. And so of changing drastically the kind of energy we experience and the kind of contents of consciousness that we experience. Again, it's not necessarily pathological. It may even be helpful. It gets us out of the ordinary, everyday ego state for a little while and opens up some kind of channel between the ego and the unconscious. And when this circumstance wears off, we're back to our normal, everyday state and maybe a little bit better for it, maybe not. Now, I make a distinction between altered state of consciousness and mystical states of consciousness. It is by no means a foregone conclusion that when you get out of the ego, you're into God, which is why we say an altered state may not be an experience of God. It may be an experience of your own unconscious or of the effect of a drug or something. I say that because there's almost a presumption in some circles that the ego is the only obstacle to the experience of God. As we'll see later on, that's not true at all. God is perfectly capable of reaching us at the level of ego. At least our tradition accepts that as fact. And that assumption goes further that once you get out of the ego, especially the mental ego, then you're smack in the middle of God in some way. And anything you can do that gets you out of the ego must be good. It's just not true. The mystical state, then, I'm defining as a state in which the ego is not sitting in the middle, directing and controlling everything. Our intentionality and our energy are infused with the will and the energy of God. We're still there, but again, this intentionality is really what gives us our sense of a center. In our center, in our will, in our intention, in our basic focus, we experience ourselves in a mystical state as being encountered by not our will to God, but God's will to human. That our will to God and God's will to human have in some way come together. And where my will and God's will have become one will. Where my psychic energy and the uncreated loving energy of God are in some beautiful kind of a harmony. So that you might say, as St. John of the Cross said, the soul doesn't know if it is God or if God is the soul. Now, he would never say that the soul is God or anything like that, you know. But there's a profound union that exists. And yet somehow in a mystical state, I still know that I am me and God is an other. And yet there is a unity between us that cannot be denied. So mystical state, as we're defining it here, a mystical state of consciousness is a state of consciousness that has to do with an experience of God. Okay? And we make one more distinction and then we'll take a break, and that is psychic states. The psychic state may be mystical and it may not. It may be an altered state and it may not. In a psychic state, the contents of our consciousness are infused with psychic information and psychic intelligence. But our intentionality is under the control of the ego. All right, what does that mean? And remember, the contents of consciousness would include things like our thoughts, our memories, our feelings. For a person in a psychic state, the contents are not merely thoughts and feelings and things like that, or maybe they're the kinds of thoughts that have nothing to do with their own individual personhood. They're experiencing the thoughts of another person, or they're seeing in their consciousness some reality that is taking place somewhere else, clairvoyance, or they're experiencing an energy that is not merely for them, but to be given away to another, as in a psychic healing kind of a experience. So what's being changed in a psychic state is largely the contents of the consciousness. The kind of information we are experiencing is not normal. Or maybe it'll be normal in 300 years, but it's not normal now. It's not normative. It's normal for people to be experiencing in their consciousness thoughts and memories and things like that, not telepathy and clairvoyance and clairaudience and psychic kinds of information. Again, this psychic information may be infused with the divine will and energy. You see a lot of this, for example, and I think this is something that the charismatics invite. What are the charismatic gifts? They are psychic gifts. Are they not? Gifts of healing, gift of tongues is a kind of clairaudience. The gift of knowledge, knowing what another person is going through. These are psychic gifts. And they are supposedly arising at the energy field. It's a more intense energy field that the psychic is experiencing. I think it takes more psychic energy for these gifts to be awakened. And the group is manufacturing this energy, and they're doing it while focusing on God, and so through the power of the Holy Spirit and the presence of the Holy Spirit, more intense energy is being awakened, and people who have any kind of a leaning toward a psychic gift are experiencing these gifts to build up the community. That's what charismatic gifts are about. If you want to, it's a combination of the psychic and the mystical here. So one thing you can say about psychic gifts, though, is when you say they're only under partial ego control, it means most psychics cannot experience these gifts at will. There is a gratuitousness about these gifts. They come when they come, and they go when they go. Very, very few psychics can just decide to be clairvoyant or telepathic. They usually find that they slip into some kind of a circumstance or consciousness, and then that's pretty normal for them. And then that slips away. And they don't always understand that. So these radio psychics and telephone psychics that are always turned on in their psychic gifts are generally a fraud. But people, are, of course, are paying the money anyway, so you will get what you pay for, believe me. Nothing. So now we've made some distinctions here between different kinds of consciousness, okay? That's where we are so far in this. And I think, you know, you can maybe even project where this is all going. When we talk about Kundalini as an energy, then what has to happen in all of these other areas for this energy to be compatible, for this energy to work within us? That's what we're going to do. Any questions or comments as we close off this little section? Yes.
Have you had a personal psychic experience?
Oh, I've had many psychic experiences.
Give us examples.
Well, I think most people have had psychic experiences. I don't think they're at all uncommon. A very simple psychic experience that I'll bet everyone has had is you'll be thinking about someone and the phone will ring and there they are. Has that ever happened to you? That's a kind of a very simple psychic experience. Or you'll be humming a song in your mind and turn on the radio and there it is. That's just the exact same point. Or have some sudden feeling come upon you that someone you love has just been harmed or has died or something. And it's true, they have. Or of losing something and then just all of a sudden you know where it is. Those, I didn't used to think those were psychic experiences, but they are. They're psychic experiences. In charismatic communities, sometimes you have some that are a little more, outstanding, perhaps, of tuning into some person's memory that is repressed, speaking of it, and yes, there it is, it comes out. You know, those things do happen, or praying with someone for a healing, and they are healed. That happens. So I've had those, and I'll bet you all have deja vu experiences. I think can be a kind of psychic experience. Is that? I would not consider myself a psychic, though. That this Kundalini awakening has not produced an abundance of those kind of gifts in me. It's gone in another direction. For some people, that is one of the things that happens to them, though, is the awakening of Kundalini really awakens profound psychic gifts, which remain there for them. Because again, psychic gifts, if you say like the everyday ego is functioning at this level of energy and psychic gifts function at this level, perhaps the only thing that keeps us from experiencing more psychic gifts is we don't have enough energy. If you raise the energy level, then this next whole system of intelligence begins to awaken. We're always kind of on the edge of it, and every now and then there's enough energy and something pops through. But when you really raise the energy coming into consciousness, well, there's these gifts all over the place. There's this whole way of knowing, okay? And so everybody from time to time does get enough energy to get up in there, you know. But just as with our other forms of intelligence, some people have more than others, you know, it's true. You find that with psychic gifts. Not everybody is equally endowed with psychic gifts. Some people are extremely gifted in that area, and some people, like myself, I would say, don't have an awful lot of that. So the Kundalini energy for me did not produce a flowering of psychic gifts, which is probably just as well. I would have maybe never been able to get over the wonder of that and keep going with where this thing was really trying to take me, okay? Other questions?
In the gifts of tongues, is this actually a language these people are talking, and is it the same language, or what is it?
Well, it can be that. It's usually not. It's a prayer language is the way it's better referred to. It's a nonsensical stringing together of syllables that directs our intention and attention toward God in a way that normal everyday verbal language does not. Now, I'll say a little more about that gift as we go along, the gift of glossolalia, okay, because it's been a very important feature in my own growth. I've had this spontaneous glossolalia ever since 1973. And it's been important to me in integrating the Kundalini. Yeah. Anything else?
Where did you fit in this level of dreams and sleeping state of consciousness? Is that normal somewhere in there?
Well, dreams would be an altered state.
I mean, you're actually asleep and...
Yeah. Remember, I said altered states are not necessarily bad or pathological. We are consciously experiencing something, but the ego is not directing what we experience. And so that's true of the altered state. In abnormal, we're experiencing something and it's unpleasant and we can't control it, okay? So a dream is a natural altered state of consciousness. So when anybody criticizing us for being in the New Age because we are about altered states of consciousness, you can just say, well, you have them every day. And, you know, every time you dream, you're having an altered state of consciousness. Every time you're just waking up in the morning and you're somewhere between all these worlds, you know, and trying to decide which one you're going to live in today, that's an altered state of consciousness. Okay? Yes.
And dreams are not controlled by the ego?
No, they're not. Dreams are not controlled by the ego. The ego may be an actor in the dream. It may be symbolized in the dream. Whenever you see yourself in the dream, and many of you see yourself in the dream, you know, you're watching yourself walk around. That is the ego. What you're seeing walk around is the ego. But now here's something. Who is watching the dream? Ah, that's the big daddy, huh? Yeah, that's right. That's that deep self. Who is watching the whole thing? That's the playwright, too. Yeah, that's the one who's put this thing together, and it's trying to show the ego how it sees the ego. This is how I see you. You're walking around with your friends, and okay, so it's mirroring back to you. Anything else? Okay, are we pretty straight on this so far, the way I'm using these words? Because I certainly want to make especially a distinction between a mystical state and an altered state, because as we'll see later, the Kundalini can be awakened through altered states, but that doesn't mean you have a mystical experience. All right, that's kind of where this is starting to go. Okay, we're together so far on this understanding of consciousness as attention, intention, contents, and energy coming together in various ways, egoic, non-egoic, and so forth, and making these distinctions between these different kinds of consciousness, five different kinds: normal, abnormal, altered states, mystical states, psychic states, where we've got a little foundation for talking about the rest of the day. Now let's see if there's any other questions or comments that have come up during the break. Yes?
You're going to tell us how to develop this energy, number one. And number two, you're going to tell us where this led you.
Okay, am I going to tell you how to develop this? And yes, and where this led me. Yes, so we're going to certainly move in that direction. Okay, although I don't know that the answer to the first is going to be too thoroughly developed. How to develop this, we'll say some things about that.
Is it in one of your books?
The book Kundalini Energy and Christian Spirituality has a lot of what I'm talking about today, although since I've written that book, when you have some material, the way you develop it for a book is frequently different from the way you develop it for a workshop. And so some of what I'm doing today is not found in the book. Okay. Anything else? Yes, Father Bob.
Can you experience both or more than one dimension simultaneously, like altered state and mystical state at the same time?
Yes, you can. Although, again, you would call it a mystical state if it was a if God was really in the center of all of this, then we would call it a mystical state, even though it might share some of the qualities of an altered state. We would call it mystical because of the primary influence of the divine in here. Okay?
Yes, like a dream. Like sometimes the scriptures, you see our Lord speaking to a person in a dream.
Right,
okay,
right.
So a dream, say, yes. It's an altered state, but yet a mystical, because that's the focus.
Oh, good point. The dream is frequently a mystical experience. Even though the mystical experience is coming through the medium of a dream, it's a mystical experience. A mystical experience can be in a framework of an altered state, you know, where the ego is not sitting in the middle directing things and it's not unpleasant, and a semi-trance state and a contemplative kind of prayer, something like that. But frequently a mystical experience is in a fully conscious state. That's why I say I want to make that point clear. You can be listening to a homily and have a mystical experience. How about that? It can be. You can be reading the scriptures with your eyes wide open in your full ego consciousness, and yet your intentionality and your awareness and the contents and the energy that you begin to experience are charged with the divine and not the normal everyday kind of energy and content orientations that you have. You see, so it's mystical states. We can say, yeah, they frequently do take place in a kind of an altered state form, but they can also take place in a more normal state. Okay, sometimes, again, we have a tendency to think of mystical states as more in an altered state form, but not necessarily so. Okay, anything else? Now, let's add one piece to this, which is the body. Has anybody in here ever had an experience outside of the body?
Out of body.
See, out of body. How do you know you were out of your body?
Because I could see it.
Okay, you could see it.
And I knew I was connected to it.
All right, you were connected to it, and that's the point. Even the out-of-body experience is somehow connected to the body. That silver thread or whatever it is that connects us to the body. Well, so those experiences are there, and astral travels and things like that. But 99.99999% of our experiences are in the body, right? Even our mystical experiences, even our altered state experiences are in the body. So the body is an aspect of consciousness. It is certainly a provider of some of the contents of consciousness, like sensory information, right? Remember, contents is one of the things of consciousness. I'm going to write that on the board again here. Attention, intention, plus contents, plus energy. Well, according to the old philosophers, all of our experiences of consciousness begin with sensory information, and then are upgraded in some way to concepts and beyond concepts and whatnot. But where would we be as human beings without sensory information? I mean, it so colors everything that we have, and the body is a provider of this, not just through the, well, if you include the whole sense of touch and the experiences of the organs of the body have to be part of that sensory information. Our experience of hunger and thirst and breath and aches and pains, well, that's not seeing and hearing and smelling, but it's still sensory information. What is the body? Well, in the East, you know, you have a tendency sometimes to hear the body talked about as almost an accidental. The soul is what's real, and it takes a body to itself and expresses through this body and learns. So the body is a kind of a context for learning. And then after this lifetime is over, that body is dropped and it'll hang around somewhere in the afterlife and choose another set of parents and incarnate and go through some more learning in its journey to the divine. I'm not saying that to ridicule, but I'm saying that that's a very different understanding of the body that we have than we have in the Judeo-Christian tradition. For us, the body is the physical expression of the soul. And you're like that. The soul is not in the body. The body is in the soul. The physical body exists because the soul is giving it existence. The soul is what is giving the body its life and its form, its specifically human shape and character. The soul is metaphysically deficient without the body, which is another very different view of the body than we have in the East. As holistic as the East is, it's still a very different view of the body. Somehow in the East, the body is not an essential part of one's personhood. The spiritual is essential, and all things physical and material are sometimes viewed as illusions. So a healthy body must be had in the East in order to realize your spiritual consciousness in this body, which is nice, that's good. That's wonderful reason to go for a holistic spirituality. But in the West, there's something different, or in Christianity, the Judeo-Christian. Our understanding of the soul is that the soul is created to inform a body. And without the body, it is somehow lacking. And so in the Catholic tradition, we speak of after death, the soul exists in an intermediate state. It may know God. It may share already in the beatific vision, but there is another fulfillment to come that we call the resurrection of the body. All of this rather highfalutin, abstract discussion is significant in this respect is to say that the body is an essential part of our consciousness, not just a context for us to be learning. It's as essential to our personhood as our intellect and our will and our intuition and anything else. The physical is as important for human beings as the spiritual. Okay? The body provides senses which allow the rest of our consciousness to begin their action. The body provides a means by which consciousness can express itself in this world. Now, these different states of consciousness we talked about previously affect the body in different ways. Let's talk about that. When we say that everything that happens to us, except these very rare experiences of being out of the body, when we say that we have all of our experiences in the body, we are not affected in the body in the same way by all of our experiences. We feel our energy in different ways in different parts of the body. Let's try some little meditation on that to get an idea of how the body and consciousness are connected energetically, how they communicate. Notice a few things here. Where do you feel your energy in your body when you are about to be evaluated by your boss or supervisor? Is there a part of your body that feels energy in a very concentrated kind of way? In the pit of your stomach, you feel that. You're going to be evaluated. If you get a poor evaluated, you lose your job. Okay? You might even feel that in your rear end, a tightness there. Where do you feel when your energy when you're watching the news and there's been a terrible accident and a little child is crying because she's lost her mother? And they show that for a few seconds on the news. Where do you feel your energy acting in your body when you see this little child who's just desolate for the loss of her mother? You feel that in your heart. Yes. I wonder why. Okay. Where do you feel your energy when you're at a movie that you've been watching and you're very interested, and there's a chase scene in which the bad guys are after the good guy and they're really gaining ground, and the good guy is coming to a cliff, he can't go anymore? Where do you feel your energy? Kind of around the heart, maybe right here, the solar plexus area, a tightness where you're just rooting and pulling for the good guy, right? All right. Where do you feel your energy when you're watching a love scene in a movie, a highly sexually explicit love scene, and you get past your superegoic critical judgmentalism and just enter into the energy of the love scene? Well, we know where that energy goes, right? Okay. And finally, where do you feel your energy when you are simply gazing in appreciation at a beautiful sunset? You're not trying to analyze it or interpret it. You don't want to do anything with it. You don't want to draw it in a notebook. You just want to look at it and see it. Where do you feel your energy? Whole body, some say. Okay. Where do you feel your energy when you're sitting in the audience and someone calls upon you to come forward and say a few words? Do you perhaps have a lump in your throat? notice what some of those metaphors we have in our language say about consciousness and energy and body. We say so-and-so makes us sick to our stomach, right? And they do. Or they give us a pain in the neck, right? They really do give you a pain in the neck, don't they? Yes. Or I had butterflies in my stomach. Yes, that too. Or a lump in my throat. You see? All those metaphors are metaphors about how consciousness is experienced in the body. Okay, this begins to suggest to us something of energy centers in the body, energy centers of consciousness are suggested by this. Even though this is a common experience that many of us have, and many of us also have some other experiences of rubbing ourselves here or here. You know, people do these things spontaneously. They'll give themselves a little massage in different parts of the body and feels pretty good.